I'm going to call the meeting to order. We do have a quorum, and Representative Dabney, your bill is up first.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members. Thank you very much for the opportunity to be here today.
Welcome to the committee.
You have House File 419 before you. There is an amendment.
Is that the 2285 amendment?
If you'll give me just a moment, Madam Chair, I can confirm that. Yes, ma'am.
Representative Saylor, do you want to move the bill and the amendment?
Yes, Madam Chair, I'll move the bill.
Okay, Representative Saylor moves House File 419, and we have an amendment. So Representative Saylor moves House File A10, 2285, which would put it in the form the author wants, I believe.
That's correct, Madam Chair.
So we're going to vote on the amendment. Any discussion? If not, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no. Motion prevails, and the bill as amended is before us.
All right. Thank you, Madam Chair. This has become a simpler bill since this committee was good enough to hear it last year. It's simply now as amended, and I thank you for that. Request the Commission of Health to work with other stakeholders to look to develop recommendations on health actions and follow-up services for children whose blood lead level exceeds 5 micrograms of lead per deciliter of blood. I know I was never very good at science. With me today to be able to speak to it is one of the agencies or organizations that's been involved with this, Mr. Yaman, from the MCEA.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Yaman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Samuel Yaman from Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy. I did also bring along a few handout materials. I wanted to ask one of the staff could please distribute those. There's a fact sheet that my organization prepared. There's also a resolution on this issue from Minnesota Public Health Association. And finally, there's also a letter of support from the Sustainable Resources Center, SRC. That's a nonprofit firm that does the lead work in homes in Minneapolis, and now also SRC has a mandate and funding to begin to expand beyond just the city of Minneapolis. So those are the people that do the work, and unfortunately they couldn't be here with us today because they're out doing the lead work. In any case, the motivation for this legislation is that science is showing that lead in the environment impairs children's health and development at exposure levels below the existing federal limit of 10 micrograms per deciliter. And as Representative Dabney has described, legislation is calling for development of guidelines that would recommend public health actions, substantive public health actions, at a more protective level. 5 micrograms per deciliter. This is the amount of lead that's measured in children's blood samples. This would help ensure that all children have the opportunity to reach their full potential. Again, as Representative Dabney mentioned, the legislation calls upon Minnesota Department of Health, MDH, to gather together the appropriate experts, city and county health departments, lead abatement practitioners like SRC, and medical professionals, the appropriate parties to gather together in a meeting and determine what's the best way to revisit and amend the existing guidelines, one specific aspect of the existing guidelines, not the entirety of those guidelines on children's lead case management, to bring those up to date with today's science. The health hazards of lead are, of course, well known, but it's still an issue, and compared to 20 years ago when the federal guidelines were last revised, we now have a large and growing body of studies showing that the last time the limit was revised, it made sense based on the science in 1991. In 2010, we have a large and growing body of studies showing that children's exposures to lead below the existing standard are no longer protective. Studies showing there's an impact on children's IQ. That's a significant measurable impact on intelligence, development, psychological tests, and these lower Historically, lower exposures to lead are also now identified as a risk factor for ADHD, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, a costly problem both to families and since there's a large number of children in the nation with that problem. It's a cost to our nation and the schools, and I think we're all familiar with the impacts of that condition. But if there's a proportion of those that are preventable by actions such as the legislation that Representative Dabney has proposed, then MCEA believes it's worth acting on that to reduce the impact of this disease and enable all children to reach their full potential and succeed in the education system, and also to contribute in the the rebuilding the economy and just building the future of the economy. These are the people we're going to depend on to succeed and be the professionals as we get older. And on the economic side, I'll just mention also, even though today's lead levels in children's blood are lower than a generation or two ago, and that's good, that's a great thing, of course, but we still have some unfinished business. And on the economic side, even today's lead exposure levels are associated with huge impacts, billions of dollars to the U.S. economy. So it's not only a moral imperative to protect children's health and development from this well-known toxin, but it makes good economic sense and represents a good investment. So just to briefly reiterate what the proposed legislation does and does not do, as Representative Dabney mentioned, it calls for a convening of the appropriate experts in the state to figure out how to best handle these relatively lower but still hazardous lead exposures to children, and how we can, as a society, work to keep building on all the success that we've had over the last 30 or 40 years in reducing children's lead exposures. But partly why MCEA views this as unfinished business is that we're not saying that our government agencies and our health professionals and medical professionals haven't been doing a good job, because we know that they've been doing a great job to reduce this problem. We just see the door is still a little bit ajar, and we'd like to have the situation be that no children are having their educational success or their IQ or their psychological well-being and development impacted by a toxin that we know is entirely preventable. So with that, Madam Chair, I'll conclude my testimony, but we'll remain for questions.
Thank you. Any questions from committee members? Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For those of us that weren't real good, maybe like Representative Dabney with the whole metric thing, and can you put in perspective a deciliter and a microgram for us, please?
I'm going to throw that to Dr. Yaman.
Mr. Yaman, we know you're a scientist.
Madam Chair, Representative, these are amounts of a toxic heavy metal in a small sample of blood. And so as a first round, children that are in certain demographic groups that are known to be at higher risk for lead exposure are tested with a simple prick to the finger to take out just a little bit of blood. And then later there's a follow-up test, a venous test, to draw blood directly from the vein to get a more accurate reading on the amount of lead. And it's an odd unit, even for people that are used to the environmental sciences and the metric units. It's a little bit of it's an odd unit to say micrograms per deciliter instead of putting it in something that's more directly translatable to parts per million, parts per billion. But that's just the standard unit. So I hope that answers your question. It's just the amount of the toxic heavy metal that's in the blood sample that's taken to.
Representative Scott.
That didn't clear it up for me at all. Give me a sample. Give me a comparative, something that's close to a deciliter and something, tangible that the average person can understand.
No, something that Representative Morgan is dying to jump in here.
Okay.
And he might have a little.
Madam Chair, Representative Scott, a deciliter is on the order of a half a cup, a little less than a half a cup. That's pretty darn small.
Madam Chair.
Definitely.
I'm with him on pretty darn small. but I think the point here for us non-scientists is what are the clinical thresholds? Because I don't think there's a debate about how you measure it or, you know, on the measurement issues there. What is the clinical threshold at which point health authorities should be responding to that child's health? And at this point, it's 10 micrograms per deciliter, and the science seems to be indicating that there's negative effects on the children at lower levels than the 10. And so we're trying to spark the conversation on how to respond to those lower blood levels.
Representative Dabney, I just want to thank you for bringing this bill forward, and also Mr. Yaman. You know, really what we know is 1 microgram per deciliter is toxic to a child. There should be no lead ever. It's not a nutritious substance to put in a child's bloodstream or any of our bloodstreams, but the kind of damage that it does, especially the wee little ones. Wee little ones, like I know we have mm-hmm. parents up here on this committee, it's just dust. It's in the dust that they start crawling around in. It's toxic to their brains, and it never can be remediated. If it gets to a certain level, it's going to cause damage that the person has all their life. So did you have another hand up over here? So really we should almost say, you know, as soon as there's any indication that a child has been exposed to lead dust, you want to really start intervening right away, cleaning up that lead dust and making sure they don't continue to be exposed. Representative Benson.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. When we have issues like this, and those of us who are laymen, I think are wise then to look to science. Science should be the decider here, not ideology. And I'm very supportive, of course, of the bill.
And Madam Chair,
Representative
Debbie? Just to reinforce some of your comments, I've had conversations with both the MMA and representatives and pediatricians. They're comfortable with the legislation this year. Last year's legislation, they had some hesitations about, but I think it's fair to say that everyone's now holding hands.
Great. Good work. Any questions from anybody else? If not, the bill as amended, House File 419, is before us, and it will be, do you want it to travel on its own? Returning it to finance, I guess.
Yes, apparently needs to go to finance.
Representative Saylor renews her motion. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no. The motion prevails, and the bill is on its way to finance. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Representative Morgan. Welcome to your committee.
Madam Chair, members, thank you very much. If you'll allow me to move consideration of House File 2353 for possible inclusion in the committee's omnibus bill.
Okay, Representative Morgan moves House File 2353 be considered for inclusion in the omnibus bill. Please go forward with your witness.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, this bill deals with the unique relationship between manufactured park home residents and the owners of the manufactured park homes. In most cases, manufactured park residents own the home they live in, and yet they rent the land on which that home sits from the owners of the parks where they live. As that is the case, we think there is a necessity for a unique dispute resolution model for disputes that arise between the landlords and the tenants in this unique relationship. I have with me Justin Bell from the All Parks Alliance for Change, who will talk about the unique remedy we have proposed in this bill, House File 2353, and he has with him a couple of other testifiers who are going to help tell the story about why this is so important. So I'll turn it over now to Mr. Bell.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Bell.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. My name is Justin Bell, and I'm the Legal and Policy Director for All Parks Alliance for Change. We're a statewide organization that represents the rights of residents of manufactured housing and also works to preserve manufactured home communities. I was at the dentist before I came here, and half of my face is still numb, so if at any point I'm a little hard to understand, I apologize. As most of you know, residents of manufactured home communities live in a very unique situation. Not completely a homeowner, not completely a renter. Residents who own their home and rent the land that it sits on operate under a special area of law, Minnesota Statute 327C, and their leases are treated differently to reflect the investment they put in up front to move their homes into a community. This arrangement allows for low to moderate income affordable home ownership, and manufactured homes in Minnesota are more than 80% owner occupied. In over 900 communities, there are over 50,000 homes, and almost 180,000 Minnesotans live in manufactured housing. This unique and valuable form of affordable housing comes with property interests that are often put into competition with each other. At APAC, we run a legal helpline, and every day we hear from residents and the different forms that these disputes take. Often, residents can call and already recite the law and the statute to us, or they can read us their lease over the phone. When they ask us what to do about a violation that seems to have occurred, we always advocate that they speak with their community managers or their community owners first. But when those concerns fall on deaf ears, the resident can only file a civil lawsuit to exercise their rights and the protections they are afforded under their lease or state law. So many residents of manufactured home communities are low to very low income that hiring an attorney is most often not an option, and legal aid has only enough budget and staff to make the most dire and time-sensitive cases. Often the violation of law or lease has to do with an added fee or some other situation that adds financial strain onto an already struggling homeowner. The longer the violation continues, the greater the risk of the resident falling behind on their budget and potentially eviction can result. Once a resident is evicted, if they can't sell or move their home out of the community, they lose the home and all the investment they had in the home. Finding an efficient, affordable, and equitable way to resolve these disputes has been a focus for APAC for several years. Our members were very excited and inspired by a program in Washington State that allows for dispute resolution through their Attorney General's office. When it became clear to us that the exact same program wasn't possible in Minnesota, we looked for alternatives that could produce the same results. The Offices of Administrative Hearings has had great success in making civil violations more efficient with a number of different programs, and we believe that the program they've designed for residents and community owners would achieve the goals that our residents have been looking for: speedy and affordable access to justice. And I should also mention that we've been in ongoing conversations with the MMHA, community owners, and the industry group to try to address their concerns over something like this and to try to come up with a program that works for everybody. And I brought with me today one of our community leaders from Maplewood, and also Judge Bruce Johnson from the Offices of Administrative Hearings can talk about how the program will work in their offices.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Welcome to the committee. If you just introduce yourself, please.
Hello, committee chairman, woman. My name is Paul Ruby. I live in 1334 Pearson Drive in Maplewood. We live in a mobile home community of 357 homes. I'm president of the association there, and we have all kinds of problems, but we won't get into that right here. I own my own home, but we rent the land that it sits on. This arrangement allows me to be a homeowner. I have a substantial investment in my home, and I would not be able to pay the $4,000 to $8,000 it would cost to move it, assuming that it could be safely moved and legally moved if I could find somewhere to move it. And, of course, the $4,000 would be like a single wide, and if you had a double wide, which Bar Park has about half double wides, if it was double wide, it would be closer to $12,000. So you see, this is a problem. Most communities in Minnesota will not allow homes older than 10 years to be moved in. Now, although this arrangement of owning a home, the leasing the land has the benefit of being affordable, but it also results in clashing property interests and rights. Many types of disputes arise from this situation. If my rights under the law or under my lease are violated, my only remedy is to file a lawsuit. I cannot afford to hire an attorney and pursue a civil suit. Legal aid will take eviction cases because they're immediate. But if the violation is anything short of eviction, it's unlikely that legal aid could represent me due to the unbelievably high cost of doing that. If I'm looking for monetary relief or injunctive relief, that would be found there. Or even if it could, shrinking budgets and demanding caseloads have conciliation courts seeing from 2 to 8 months delays for hearings and judgments. If a rule or modification of my lease is illegally imposed, the violation simply keeps occurring until I can get a judgment. This could result in a new illegal charges for utilities or services, or could result in an illegal lot rent increase. If I did not comply with the illegal change, I could be evicted. Eviction proceedings happen on a faster timeline than civil trials or even conciliation court in many instances. If a resident lives on a tight or a fixed income, as many manufactured home residents do, any cost or hardship associated with an illegal charge could have dire results. We want an inexpensive and efficient means to address these issues. In Washington State, the plan was developed to allow residents of manufactured home parks to file a complaint with the Attorney General's office and when there was an alleged violation of a statute, their leases or their rights. The process is was much cheaper and faster than a civil court case. We've approached the Attorney General here about a similar program, and we were unsuccessful primarily because of the cost associated with a program like this. This program at the Office of Administrative Hearings would allow myself and other residents to file a complaint and get a resolution through mediation or a hearing in front of an administrative law judge within 30 days from filing the complaint to holding a final judgment. The cost would be minimal and would be split between the parties. This program would keep cases out of the overloaded court system as they are facing even more budget cuts. And this program, I must reiterate this is the best part. This program costs the state and the taxpayers nothing. Nada. Zip. Costs nothing. Please help myself and other 180,000 Minnesotans who live in manufacturing homes to find a cheap and fast way to address these type of violations we're having. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
And now, Madam Chair, I'd like to ask Judge Johnson to maybe talk about how the program would work through his offices.
All right, thank you. Judge Johnson, welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, members, I'm Bruce Johnson. I'm Assistant Chief Administrative Law Judge at the Minnesota Office of Administrative Hearings. If you'll indulge me a little bit, I just want to give you a little bit of background about our office and give you an idea of who we are and what we do. Our office was established in 1975 by the legislature, and primarily before 1975, state agencies all hired their own judges to hear the cases that the administrative hearings that they conducted, and there was some concern that there was a conflict inherent in that. We were set up as an independent state agency to conduct hearings for other state agencies initially, and we do that today. We do everything from daycare licensing hearings for the Department of Human Services to very complex utility regulation cases for the Public Utilities Commission, and frankly everything in between. Also, Chapter 14, which is the State Administrative Procedure Act, allows us to enter into contracts with political subdivisions to conduct administrative hearings for them. And I'd like to give you an example of that because it I think would help you see the model that we're proposing here. About a year ago, the city of West St. Paul came to us, and because of the pressure on the judicial system, they were unable to get their code violations heard for months and months and months. What the city did was it took a few months. They made charter revisions and enacted ordinances that converted their misdemeanor code violations into civil citations. And almost a year ago, we started hearing them. We give them the third Thursday of every month. Basically, the inspectors come in, the landowners come in, we have a judge sitting there, we actually have a secretary in the courtroom. The judge hears the evidence, basically makes a decision on the spot, the judgment is typed up, and they go out. And it has been enormously successful. I think if you were to ask the city, they're very pleased with the outcome. Actually, the number of cases has dropped off because the speed of the procedure and the certainty of compliance, people are actually voluntarily complying with the law now. In other words, the number of violations has gone down for them, which we think is a measure of how it works. Now, fiscally, our office, my division of the office, I won't get into our workers' compensation division because I don't know much about it, and I don't think that's germane here. But we operate off a revolving fund. We have a chart right now. The Department of Management and Budget essentially establishes our hourly rates every year. Right now, we're charging $160 an hour for administrative law judges. We also have staff attorneys who we charge $80 an hour. And I don't know if any of you have had the opportunity to look for counsel, but we're well below market in those fees, and we haven't changed our fees in 4 years. But the income has to equal the outgo. In other words, the revenues we get are appropriated to us for our operations. So the comment was made, this doesn't cost the state a dime. Well, the contemplation is here, the parties will bear that cost. And one of the issues is, well, how big a cost that is. First of all, the Alliance came to us. We take no positions on the merits of legislation. In other words, if this is something the legislature wants us to do, we'll do it. If it's something you don't want us to do, we won't do it. But they came to us to inquiring about process, and we did help them design the process. First of all, the process involved here is what are called our revenue recapture rules, and I won't go into why that is. They were developed essentially for state agencies and political subdivisions that wanted to get their hands on a taxpayer's refund to pay a debt. But they're very, very simplified rules, very shortened time frames. There's no discovery. Hearings at most maybe last a couple hours. So that was the model, and that's the reference in the legislation to the process. I also need to point out that the hearings don't have to be in person. We have full video conferencing capability, and I guess I want to touch on something. For the Department of Natural Resources, we hear trespass cases when a hunter crosses, you know, goes on to a landowner's land and hunting, and essentially it's a trespass. And actually, Minnesota law allows a imposition of a civil citation, and it can be enforced either by the local county sheriff or the Department of Natural Resources. Well, I say this only because I want to explain how we do those hearings. We actually do them by telephone. I will call the parties. The department will send out a notice of hearing, or we will. That will actually set the case for a pre-hearing conference, which is basically a telephone conference, probably wouldn't last more than half an hour at the most. At that time, I request the parties to send me copies of the exhibits before the date set for the hearing, which they do, so I have documentary evidence. And then I do the hearings by telephone conference call. I put the deputy sheriff and the landowner or the hunter under oath. I take their testimony by telephone. Their parties have the right of cross-examination, the whole proceeding is done in less than an hour. Now, I'm not saying that this would always apply to these kinds of cases, but that is a possibility. In other words, the legislation indicates that these could be done either by teleconference or by telephone, which in greater Minnesota would be an advantage. People wouldn't have to come to St. Paul to have the hearing. In any event, that's kind of a sketch of how our office is involved in these. I think I would feel better if members had any questions, and I'd be more than happy to try to answer them.
Any questions for Judge Johnson? Representative Severson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Judge Johnson, right now, are you maxed out on your caseload? Are you 80%? Are you 50%? Can you give me some kind of number here?
Madam Chair, Representative.
Judge Johnson.
Chapter 14 also gives us authority to contract part-time administrative law judges. We contract now with 7 lawyers. Basically, they have been contractors for many years. We have the same requirements as we do for our staff judges. What it means is if our staff gets overloaded, we have an outlet. And right now, we are nowhere near capacity. Those contract administrative law judges are paid an hourly rate, which is lower than the hourly rate we charge, so that covers the overhead. Right now, I would say, although our staff administrative law judges are pretty busy, we only call in a contract judge if one of our staff judges isn't available on a date when somebody wants to hold a hearing. And it has worked out very, very well. They tend not to do complicated things like utilities regulation. Commonly, they do a lot of the daycare and foster care licensing cases we hear, but there is quite a bit of capacity there. I would say right now none of them are billing over, $20 to $30 hours a month. So there's plenty of room for capacity.
Follow-up.
Representative Severson.
Yeah, thank you. And Judge Johnson, maybe you could articulate to the committee in terms of, say, a particular party isn't really on board with the determination that came out of the ALJ hearing, and what is the recourse after that determination has been made? Can you go up to the, you know, you can appeal the process, or how does that work?
Madam Chair, Representative, for regular contested cases, that is, cases we hear for state agencies, they come in two forms. In some instances, we make recommended decisions to the agency head who makes the final decision. And that would, for example, be true in child care licensing cases. In other cases, the legislature has given us final decision authority. An example, which is sex offender risk level appeals, and there are some cases where we have final decision authority. There are other cases where the agency makes the final decision. Whoever makes the final decision, the case is appealable to the Court of Appeals. Now, I know you might note in this legislation that this is considered to be a non-exclusive remedy. In other words, it does not prevent the parties from going to district court. And in that regard, what this process looks, first of all, there's the possibility of mediation. We do mediations for a lot of agencies. The second thing is the process itself is more in the nature of arbitration than it is a court-type hearing. And so since we would have final decision authority here, the party would have one of two options. They could either go to the Court of Appeals appealing our final decision, or they could go to district court and there are other remedies. They would have a choice. Is that a satisfactory answer?
Thank you.
Representative Severson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Judge Johnson. Yes, I guess the things that I wanted to bring out here is that I think in terms of the plaintiff, the individuals coming forward, if they aren't satisfied with the ALJ ruling, going through the appellate process, and my understanding is that in the appellate courts, they lean heavily on the ALJ's decision. In fact, it would be so overwhelming that it would almost be impossible to overrule at the appellate court side. So I guess what I'm trying to establish here is if the venue for this is actually to go through the ALJ process, which is a good point for mediation, understand that if it rules against you in this process, you're either going to, the cause for getting that overturned by the appellate court is almost non-existent in my understanding, or you're going to have to go to the district court, and at the district court level, you're going to have to hire attorneys just as you would have previously going through the ALJ route to determine that case, and that they would each be borne on their own merits. Again, the process is, I think, a good vent, but I think the the people who are advocating for this need to understand that if this does transpire, there's some binding decisions that are coming in order to get your case appealed. It's going to be more costly to go through that process.
Madam Chair, Representative, a couple of things. One, an appeal to the Court of Appeals from an ALJ decision is on certiorari. So it's actually a less deferential standard than district court, which is on direct review. But we think we are not reversed because we think we get it right. we are not, at the risk of being somewhat immodest, I've been at this for 13 years. I have never been reversed in the Court of Appeals. I was reversed once by the Supreme Court on a 4-3 after the Court of Appeals affirmed me. We take a great deal of pride in getting it right. I wouldn't say that the courts are more deferential, but I'd like to think it's because we get it right.
And just one follow-up to that, Madam Chair.
Members.
And I think that's probably correct 95% of the time. What had transpired in my own district for a watershed establishment which used an ALJ, and as I went through the entire process and read the determination, it became evident to me that the people really did not have a voice in that process, that the ALJ ruled, in my estimation, somewhat on the other side of that. And the people ended up paying 20 years of taxes that they never really saw any benefits from. And I think the issue on that particular issue is that they probably did not proceed to a court of appeals because it was going to be extremely expensive, number one. And the process meant that they had to be dedicated to the cause, which they weren't at the time. So I understand what you're saying. I agree. I think we need to look at both sides of the argument as we go forward with this.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question concerns, you're trying to stay out of the court system and that sort of thing, and I can surely appreciate that. The Supreme Court, however, ruled recently that any corporation had to be represented by legal counsel. My concern is that, some of these parks may be owned, most of them probably are, owned by a corporation. Or an LLC, something to that effect. So I'm wondering how that would affect what we're trying to do here.
Madam Chair, Representative, I wish I could quote the law out of my head, but it isn't quite that simple. The statute that defines unauthorized practice of law actually does have exceptions for managing agents, owners of small businesses. Can represent themselves without an attorney. Now, I can't go through the list of the exceptions, but I think a number of the exceptions in the statute would apply to owners of manufactured home parks. There may be cases where they might be forced. What I can tell you is this: in our proceedings, in terms of representation, we proceed the same way they would in conciliation court. The rules, the statutes are no different. So if somebody couldn't represent themselves before us, they also couldn't represent themselves in conciliation court. So I think that's the only way I could respond.
Any further questions? I do have one. What is the volume? Maybe this is a question for Mr. Ruby. I don't know. What are the APAC? If you've looked at this, what is the volume of problems that would be brought to the judge? Do you have an idea? We're talking about hearing per year. I know this has been an ongoing issue, and so maybe you have a sense of what that might be.
Madam Chair, that's very difficult to ascertain. We would argue that it's artificially low right now, any guess, because people are dissuaded by the costs or the intimidation factor or just the time frame of a civil suit or conciliation court. I know that in the spring of 2009, the Attorney General's office received several hundred complaints of people asking for some sort of alternative dispute resolution for those violations of their lease or the statute, but I can't speak directly to how many cases we would expect.
Thank you. That was last year, did you say?
The spring of 2009, yes.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, one other thing that I think might be noteworthy, and I'll bring in another program that we have, which I hope the members believe has been enormously successful, and that's our campaign complaint system. Prior to 2004, violations of the Fair Campaign Practices Act had to go to not only to district court, they had to go to a grand jury. And what was happening, it was taking forever for get them resolved. In 2004, our office got jurisdiction of that, and we do hear them, and because of the politics involved in three-judge panels. But the point is, we have a website, and over time, we have developed a searchable database of our decisions. So now, somebody who is considering making a complaint about an unlawful campaign practice can actually look and see how we've been ruling on various things. Right. And what I'm saying is, as that has occurred, the number of cases has dropped dramatically. People, the law is more well known, and I believe we could do exactly the same with this program. In other words, maintain a searchable database of our decisions on our website that I believe over time would reduce the number of complaints, because parties could look and see whether how we've ruled in similar cases over the years. Right. Excuse me, I didn't mean to take up more time.
Thank you. That's okay. We do have another witness, I believe, that wants to testify. So thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Committee
Mark Brunner from the, who's the Housing, Manufactured Housing Association. Is there anybody else who in the audience who wishes to testify? Okay. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Brunner.
Thank you. Madam Chair, my name is Mark Brunner. I'm with the Minnesota Manufactured Housing Association, and would like to first thank Representative Morgan for working with the industry in terms of our concerns with the bill. We've been meeting the past several months with the advocates as well as Representative Morgan, and we also did meet with Judge Johnson, expressing our concerns that we had in terms of process with the language in the bill. And I know Judge Johnson had indicated that, you know, there may be some holes and things that they would certainly be willing to work with us on in terms of process. But, you know, essentially, it seems that the bill is intended to try to address issues involving a dispute between the owner of a manufactured home park and a resident, and we believe that, you know, one of the remedies for that, and Judge Johnson alluded to it, would be, you know, the conciliation court process. You know, we think that's something that would be viable. Perhaps there's a little tweaking that could be done there, but that's a process that's readily available to residents. It's relatively low cost. We're not so sure that the bill in its current form would really address the issue of speed in terms of resolving situation, simply because the number, the possibility for an increased number of cases, as was alluded to by Justin Bell, in terms of the Attorney General's office having received 500 phone calls the spring of last year relative to issues. They, to our knowledge, did not take any action on any of those complaints, perhaps because they didn't reach the level of requiring the Attorney General to take action. I don't know the kinds of complaints that were there, but one of the concerns we would have is that the proponents assert that, well, there'll be a $50 filing fee, if you will, for proceeding with a complaint to the Office of Administrative Hearings, which is certainly an affordable amount. The concern we have is that those numbers would end up before the courts in terms of the, you know, possibility of 500, and there's no way in the bill currently for the Office of Administrative Hearings to have sort of a prima facie review to eliminate the frivolous kinds of complaints. You know, most of our members, or at least there are about 1,000 licensed manufactured home parks in the state, probably well over 800 of those are in greater Minnesota. So the concern our members have is with the ability to travel back and forth to St. Paul. We understand there may be some video conferencing kinds of possibilities. But again, just one of the things that we would really like to continue to work on in terms of making this a better bill. And I know the state of Washington was sort of the model for the bill, and as was alluded to, it is actually quite a bit different than what they're doing in the state of Washington. So I guess, Madam Chair, you know, we would appreciate the opportunity to continue to work with the proponents and Representative Morgan as the bill moves forward. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions from committee members?
Madam Chair.
Representative Severson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess to the testifier, just what are the major concerns that you have with the bill? Can you just kind of bulletize them for us?
Madam Chair, Representative Severson, certainly the possibility of the frivolous nature of many of the complaints that would be filed. There is a concern that, you know, because Chapter 327C is a rather complex statute, it's a section of law dedicated specifically to manufactured housing issues, then there are cases that are rather complex and not so sure that a part-time or a judge that's contracted with the office would necessarily be in a position to address those. When we initially had discussions on the bill, the belief was that the benefit to both parties would be that you wouldn't have to have attorneys involved in the process, and we're certainly not convinced that wouldn't be the case. We're not allowed to in district court have the managers, the owner's agents represent the manufactured home park in district courts, and that's been a recent change since 2008. So we don't necessarily see the cost benefits inuring to both parties. We actually see that there would be an increase in cost to our members to address a lot of the frivolous cases.
Representative Benson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, Mr. Bruner, I assume that there are frivolous complaints being presented now under the present law. What is the resolution under the present law for dealing with those?
Mr. Bruner.
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Benson, my understanding is that if there is a frivolous matter brought to the courts, the courts can address it before it actually ends up receiving a hearing.
Well, Madam Chair, if I may.
Senator Benson.
Mr. Bruner, it wouldn't be the case, though, that because of the cost of taking it to a regular court system, that those frivolous complaints are simply dropped. Is that not your concern, that instead of having to go through this new system, the present system works quite well for those you represent, because people who would like to bring, we'll call them frivolous complaints, simply give up and go away? That is more efficient, I suspect, for the people you represent.
Mr. Bruner.
Madam Chair, Representative Benson, no, actually, in terms of looking at the cost that would be involved in going forward with a frivolous complaint, or maybe something that somebody would bring to the Office of Administrative Hearings, you'll have your $50 filing fee. You will then start the clock running at the $160 an hour to go forward with the process. Now, to go to district court, I think the average somewhere between $300 and $400 is the filing fee, but that gets you your day in court, your 2 days in court, your research for the decision. So in terms of an upfront cost, yes, the $300 is more than the $50, but overall we don't see that it is going to be that great of a savings.
Representative Benson.
I'm sorry, just to follow up, that really wasn't the point I was trying to make. My point is that under the present system, because it is more expensive, people in these very low income groups may have complaints, but they simply never bring them forward because they can't afford to. Is your organization's concern that people who bring these complaints now will have a way of moving those complaints forward rather than simply dropping them as they apparently do now in most cases?
Mr. Bruner.
Madam Chair, no, that's not our you know, our interest in opposing the bill.
Okay.
Sure.
Would you care to wrap up, Representative Morgan?
Just briefly. Thank you, Madam Chair. I do appreciate Mr. Bruner's willingness to work on these issues. I think they've been very fair in discussing what their concerns are with the advocates, with myself, rather with me. And I think I appreciate Judge Johnson coming down and giving the committee a sense of how the process would work in front of the administrative law judge. And as we move forward and try to find a resolution on this, I look forward to continuing conversations with the owners and the residents' representatives to try and get an agreed-to resolution. Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, the committee, for letting us tell our story.
Thank you. And this bill will be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus committee bill. And thank you for that. Very good. I think it was really helpful to hear all the opportunities here and food for thought. The minutes are before us of March 3rd, 2010. And Representative Benson.
I'm sure I'd love to move the minutes.
Okay. Representative Benson moves the approval of the minutes of March 3rd, 2010. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no. The motion prevails. The minutes are approved and adopted. Unless there's any other business to come before this committee, I just want to remind my Republican members that I'm actually hoping to meet with you this afternoon to get your proposals on the governor's recommendations and to talk with you about the targets for this committee. Thank you. Meeting adjourned.